Okay, you guys, if you want to find a seat, we're going to go ahead and get started. So we are working our way through the book of Genesis this summer, retelling these old stories that are probably super familiar, but kind of hard to get, you know what I mean? They're ancient stories. And we have these modern imaginations, so it's a challenge to read them well, especially our story for today, the story of Noah and the Ark. I mean, we cannot read this story with modern imaginations and hope to get it. We have to try and at least a little bit think like ancient people. And it's tough because in the Bible, God lets the kids tell the story. And so it's always a little bit off. You know, when it's like when little kids talk about mom and dad as if they have superpowers and know everything, which is really nice, but not realistic at all. Although, to this day, I do swear that my mom could see through walls because she always knew when we were up to something in the other room. I don't know how, but she could know. And then by middle school, you know, it's like how little boys talk about their dads when they get into a little, like, dad off to see whose dad is cooler. I had a friend who always claimed that his dad punched a bear. But he stuck to it, man. Even through high school, he was saying, no, my dad punched a bear once, which is a weird thing to brag about, but he did. And then in the teenage years, you know, mom and dad typically undergo like a dramatic loss in IQ points. You know what I'm saying? And everything's a battle. They get blamed for everything short of climate change, you know. But then it comes back around, and eventually the kids start to see mom and dad aren't superheroes, but they're not villains. They're just normal people who are complicated and fragile and flawed and doing their best, just like everybody. And hopefully the result is a relationship that's deep and rich and lasting. And the way that God is portrayed over the course of the scripture is it kind of follows a similar progression, because God lets the kids tell the story. So early on, the story is full of magic and monsters and then rules and rewards. Sometimes God is more like a tribal chieftain who has a short fuse. Sometimes God's a disappointed parent or a jilted lover. But eventually their view of God would grow up, but it was always growing up alongside this people who were telling the story. And Israel, of course, was born in a world of polytheism. And in that world, you didn't have to try to believe in many gods. You knew for sure they were real. It was like death and taxes. This is a sure thing. And every hill had its deity, and every river had its spirit, and every nation had its own celestial customer service line, right, to the gods, which is about how helpful and attentive the gods were in those days. It was like bad customer service. That's about it. And they were moody and territorial, a little gossipy. They always put people on hold. And if something good happened, they were pleased. If something bad happened, they were displeased. And good luck figuring out why or what to do about it. And this is just how it was. It was a given in their world. So it's like if you think of Abraham. He didn't grow up humming, "How great thou art." He grew up worshiping the gods of Ur, just like everyone else. And when he heard a voice saying, "Pack up and leave," his first thought was probably, "Okay, so which god is this?" And it took time along the way for him to start to suspect this God isn't like the others. This God isn't like demanding child sacrifices and rain dances. This God is speaking in promises, calls me by name, sent me wandering, but seems to be walking with me. Still, Abraham's faith was not what you would call monotheism yet. It's actually what's called monolatry. It's when you believe still in a lot of gods, but you only worship one. Although his family would always flirt with other gods. And it didn't help that the other gods like Baal and Asherah had way better marketing than his god. I mean, their worship was a big show, including lots of sex and violence. But Yahweh was always just had these higher demands like justice and mercy and even grace. And it really wasn't until late, like the exile period, when everything fell apart and they lost their land and their country and their temple, that Israel started saying, you know what? I think maybe those other gods aren't even real. We've almost like just been projecting shadows on the cave wall. Maybe there's only one God that we've really kind of misunderstood all along. And it wasn't until then till there was a full-blown monotheism. That's late in Israel's life. And even then, they would just keep putting words in God's mouth and actions in God's hands that God would later have to disavow and just be like, look, that was not me, that was all you people. And then centuries later, these weird Jewish Christians moved to what you could call a Trinitarian monotheism, saying actually God is three persons in one essence, which is the kind of sentence that almost makes you wish you would have just stuck with polytheism, you know, at least then the math was easier to do. But my point is that their picture of God in scriptures progresses and matures over time. It grows more human, actually, even as it grows more divine. Because in the Bible, God lets the kids tell the story. And in the story of Noah and the ark, I think God's people take a big step forward. They begin to grow up a little bit in their understanding of God. It comes to them, this story, during that monotheistic phase when they were still kind of in a polytheistic, did I say mono? I mean poly, in a polytheistic world, right? Many gods. And they told this story of the flood not to be original, but to try to be honest. And in fact, what they did is they took a flood story that kind of everybody in that day and time knew and told, and then they changed the meaning of the story. So instead of a capricious God wiping out humans just to get a little peace and quiet, the Hebrew version of the story was about a God who grieves and remembers and covenants. And yeah, I was just a little bit, still a little raw. They portray God as angry and regretful. But remember, these are the kids telling the story. This is the first draft, kind of a preteen theological statement here. We have to give them time as they figure it out. And actually, for me, this is a big part of why the Bible, to me, feels so reliable, is that it's not perfect, polished, finished from the get-go. They show their work. It's kind of a field guide for this long, slow spiritual journey based mostly in failure, which feels like my life. When the kids tell the story, they often borrow things from culture and then alter them in ways that fit with this God. So most other Mesopotamian cultures had a flood story. Babylonians, Sumerians, Syrians. They did. In fact, archaeologists tell us it's likely because there was some kind of massive flood event somewhere around 2900 BCE, where the rivers swelled and the cities vanished and hundreds of thousands, if not more, people drowned. And really, the whole, their known world became flooded with water. And they did what anybody would have done in their time. They started telling stories. They asked why, not like a scientific or meteorological why, but a theological one. And their assumption was that they had somehow angered the gods, and they told stories about this. And this is where Genesis enters the scene, not as the first one to ever tell a flood story, but almost as a kind of theological remix of those stories. They reimagined the ancient flood story to make a point about the God that they were coming to know. And the story didn't focus really on how it happened, although modern Christians really get hung up on the how it happened. It really talks about why. And the story, what it reveals is this God who might not fit with how they had thought of God up to that point. But the important details in the story, they weren't like the... It's not like the dimensions of the boat or the number of animals inside and how the lions and the lambs both were okay in the same space. Although the logistics truly are hilarious if you try to read them literally. They are funny. But they weren't asking that. They were asking, how can God preserve life? What kind of God will remember mercy and keep this from happening again? These are all very relevant questions for all of us. Like, is there a God who's patient and true and faithful? A God who doesn't mind being misunderstood from time to time, as long as the story keeps going forward. So this story comes on the heels of the story we told last week about Cain and Abel. In that story, God was trying to help them see that life isn't fair. This is a deep assumption of Genesis. And there's no grace in nature. It's brutal, but there's grace in the life of God, and so humanity is supposed to embody grace within creation. So their job is not to rid the world of tension or lack or contradiction. It's to try and let the pain of their lives turn them toward one another for comfort and support. They're supposed to be their brother and sister's keeper. That's the plan. But Cain refuses. He kills his brother Abel. He's sent into exile. He cries out to God, "This is too much for me to handle. What if someone finds me and kills me?" And God says, "Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." That word seven, it's interesting in Hebrew. It's the same consonants as the word complete. And so seven also means complete or fullness. So God's forgiveness of Cain in that story is full and complete. He even marks Cain's body with some sort of mark so that people will know who he is and won't harm him. And then we're told Cain builds a city, the first city. His descendants live in tents and raise cattle. They become artists playing the lyre and the flute. He has a descendant called Tubal-Cain who's a blacksmith who forged things out of brass and iron, including swords and spears, weapons of war and violence. We're told in particular about Lamech, he was sixth generation after Adam, through Adam's son Cain. And we're given this detail about Lamech's life that signals kind of where this whole Noah narrative is going. We're told Lamech was wounded by some man, and he just kills the guy. And then he's struck by a boy, and he just kills the boy. And then he brags to his wives, "I've killed a man for wounding me and a boy for injuring me. And if Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times." Remember, this is all leading up to Noah, right? You got this descendant of Cain thumping his chest, bragging about his own violence and vengeance, claiming that God will vindicate him completely, just like Cain. He's claiming that God's mercy with Cain gives him license to kill whoever he wants for whatever reason. And so in this story, it's moving fast here. It took one generation to go from Adam and Eve to Cain and Abel and the first murder. And then it took just six generations to have Lamech just openly claiming God will vindicate him for as violent as he wants to get. And then by the seventh generation, from Adam, you have Tubal-Cain, the first arms dealer, manufacturing and selling weapons of war. And then there's this little bizarre passage, like seriously one of the weirdest things in the Bible. It's about the sons of God and this race of giants called the Nephilim, who start coming down and mating with the daughters of men who they find very attractive, it says. And it's actually just the kind of thing that was very common in polytheistic cultures. The gods were always having kids with humans, you know. And God intervenes and says humanity needs to stop it. They're trying to act like gods. They need to find their true place in the world because everything has its place. And so God intervenes and refuses to let the humans become divine. That actually, the rabbis, when you read about their interpretations of this, they all say they consider this to be a very self-conscious move against the polytheism of the day. So they're starting into it. The God of the Greeks and the Babylonians and Sumerians, that might be how they act. Israel's God acts differently. This God wants an ordered creation, and that order can't be disturbed. But it's like that's all these humans do is disturb the order, disturb the peace, mostly through their violence and through kind of blurring the boundaries between the human and the divine and disregarding the orders that God has set in motion. And then in Genesis 6:5, the dam breaks. Pardon the pun. I mean, you had to know that was coming, right? The dam breaks. And the Lord saw that the wickedness of Ha-Adam, the humans, was great in Ha-Aretz, the earth, and that every yetzer, every inclination of the makshavot, the thoughts or imagination or plans of his lev, heart, was only ra. It's usually translated evil, but it just means bad. It's usually bad. And the Lord regretted that he had made the humans on the earth and was atzab. It means aggrieved, regretful. It's a really anguished word in his heart. And the Lord said, I will wipe out the humans who have created from the face of the earth, both humanity, the animals, the birds, and the creatures, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found chen, grace, favor in the eyes of the Lord. The Hebrew people to this day have this phrase they use. It's Yetzer Hara. Say Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara. You might want to hang on to this phrase. It's very helpful. I say under my breath all of the time when I'm watching things happen. It just means the evil inclination. And it's really the oldest way of talking about the way selfishness and disorder and violence have taken hold in human life. And in Genesis here, we can see that Yetzer Hara has really taken over. It says every Yetzer, same word, was only Ra. Every inclination was bad. But God's response here is not anger, or it's not like violence. It's atzav, this painful, heart-wrenching grief and regret. So humanity's wickedness and God's grief track together always in the story. So God's not like an angry tyrant ready to pounce. God is a grieving parent. It's really the characterization here. Whose children have chosen this violent, destructive path. And it's not just ruining their lives, it's going to ruin all of creation that's getting twisted and corrupted. We're told the earth was corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence, for all living beings had corrupted their ways on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all living beings has come before me. That phrase, it's like having a vision. God is seeing into the future, can sort of see where all of this is going. And he says, because of that, they're ruining everything. I can see where it's headed. Because of them, the earth is filled with violence, so I will destroy them along with the earth. So God's portrayed as a parent whose kids are just making a mess of everything and just grieving the heart of God. And so God says, I can see where all of this is going. It's almost like I wish I would have never even had these kids. That would be better than all of the grief and just the heartsick feeling of watching them disorder and get just wreak havoc on creation. In the other flood stories, like the ancient Sumerian flood story, it's called the Epic of Atrahasis. Enlil, the god of weather, decides to destroy human beings because they're too noisy. And he can't get any sleep. And then Atrahasis, the Noah figure, escapes with the help of Ea, the water god. In the Babylonian story, it's called the Epic of Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh was an ancient king who went on a journey to find the secret of immortality. And he meets up with Utnapishtim, the Noah-like figure, who explains that he has gained immortality by being the sole survivor of a great flood. These are the other stories. And there's a lot of similarities between those stories and the Noah story. They build an ark. They cover it with pitch. They save their family. They save animals. There's a massive rain and flood. They release birds to see if there's land, if the waters have subsided. And all of those details are kind of involved in the scriptures story. But they tell a very different story of God's response to the disorder and corruption and violence that's overtaken the earth. Because instead of keeping the earth, they're destroying it. Instead of keeping their brother and sisters, they've chosen Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. And violence and disorder have just taken over the earth. There's no shalom. There's shakath. It's corrupted. It's ruined. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. It's serving chaos and barrenness. And it's not doing God's dream for the world, God, the right ordering. That dream is feels like it's over. God can see where this is going. It's not going to happen. And so the question hanging over the whole story is, what will God do with the chaos, right? As it's a creation is just running now off the rails, and God can see it toward a whole different future. And so the question is, what will God do? And whatever God does will say a lot about what kind of God it is that they think they're serving. We were all probably taught kind of a straightforward, I mean, it's like brush your teeth, then bam, orange juice, that's life, right? That's how John Mulaney says it. Just a brutal, you know, humans deserved it and God just killed everyone. But it's really not the way the Jewish people talk about this story. It's really not there so much in the Hebrew language, as best as I can understand it. If you look at the context, the language, the other flood stories going on at that time, and really pay close attention to it, God is not actually causing the destruction in this story. The humans have caused it. That's what it's accentuating. By abusing their freedom and God's grace. If you remember, in the early chapters, the symbol for chaos in the world was Tehom, the deep waters of the abyss and chaos. And the way Israel tells this story in their flood narrative is that God doesn't so much cause the flood as God gives people over to the chaos that they keep pursuing and producing, and the chaos they've chosen with their freedom. So what God does essentially in the story is God speeds the story up to its inevitable conclusion. Just let it be over quickly, because there's no stopping it at this point. Humanity's chosen chaos and destruction. Let's not drag it out. Let's get through it as quickly as we can and just let it be done, like rip off the Band-Aid. And this is a very different story than the gods of the other cultures of their time. In the beginning, God spoke into the chaos, dividing, remember, the waters above from the waters below. The waters above are held back by a dome, and the sky, the waters below are held back by the land. And it creates this habitable zone in the middle. And here what God does is just open the windows and the doors. God just, like, undoes those actions, letting the sky waters fall down and the chaos from the deep comes up and envelops the land once again. And so symbolically, it's a decreation story. Humanity has chosen disorder and chaos and violence, and it's swamping the world. A die is cast, and so God is portrayed as just sort of speeding it up to its inevitable conclusion. Except there's this one man, Noah, who God calls righteous in his generation. It's kind of like righteous when you're grading on a curve against everybody else. And he gives Noah grace. He says, make yourself an ark of gopher wood. You are to make an ark with rooms and cover it with pitch, both outside and incense. And he gives him all these instructions on what to do, how to fill it with animals and food. And on the 17th day of the second month of the 600th year of Noah's life, all the fountains of the great deep, Tehom, were broken up, and the windows of the sky were opened, and it rained on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. And God's work of creation succumbs again to chaos. And it's a total loss. It's water from above, from below, comes and just swamps everything. And so God's answer to the question about the chaos that humanity is producing is really just to let humanity have its freedom. That's how they tell the story. To let them break, undo the order of creation. But then chapter 8 begins with this stunning declaration. It says, God remembered Noah and every living thing, and all the livestock with him on the ark. So now we're getting to the real reason they've included this story at all, which is that nobody avoids the flood. Nobody avoids the flood. just personally. The waters of chaos come for everyone eventually. Moments or seasons of life when chaos just overtakes us and we don't have peace and right order. Our lives are disordered and unmanageable. And all we really need to know in that moment is what kind of God do we have? One who remembers or one who forgets? And then nobody avoids the flood socially, politically, corporately. Humans abusing our freedom, giving over to corruption and violence, and then claiming that God is actually vindicating the violence, the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclinations. I mean, forget about the days of Noah. This is where we are right now in our world. So it's a very relevant question hanging over this story because of how disordered our world is. What kind of God do we have? One who can remember or one who forgets? What the story says is God remembered Noah and kind of makes the ark into this seedbed of a new creation that makes it through the flood. And over the centuries, the Jewish people and then later Christians, they would wrestle with this question. Is God going to remember us when the chaos comes? It's in the Psalms and the Proverbs, it's in the prophets, in every story of a barren woman or a struggling monarch. Anytime the waters of chaos threatened the people of God, the big fear was God would forget about them. And the chaos of our lives, our own lives, kind of begs the same question. Will God remember or forget? And what Israel preserved in this story is that this God who they were just figuring out all along, this God is a God who remembers. Even the waters of chaos can't cloud the memory of God. This is deep in the Hebrew imagination. I mean, think of Mary's song from the Gospel of Luke. He has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy. God remembers. Think of Daniel in the lion's den. We're told God remembers Daniel. Think of Joseph in prison in Egypt. God remembered Joseph. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the furnace. It says God remembered them. To remember is to, in a sense, take something that has been dismembered and remember it. Stitch it back together to God, to itself, to others, to creation, rightly ordered. God is remembering. God's memory is the last ground of hope. It's what orders creation. God remembers, and that remembering draws us back into the story, back into a life of order and flourishing. I mean, you think about how much water plays into the life of Christ and his actions. It's a lot. He turns water into wine, passes through the waters of baptism, calms the seas and quiets the storm. He walks on the water, like orders the chaos enough that he can walk on the chaos, water's chaos. He crosses the waters from Jewish land to Gentile land and back. I mean, Christ is revealing this God who is about ordering chaos through remembering things that have been dismembered. And doing this always through an offer of grace. It's always through grace. In the story, what happens is the storm ends. God sends wind to dry the land. The ark comes to rest on Mount Ararat. Noah and his family emerge from the ark. All the animals get out, take off. He builds an altar, worships God. It's looking good. And then he plants a vineyard, and then he makes some wine. It's not looking so good now. Then he gets hammered drunk and passes out completely naked in his tent and ends up cursing one of his own children. And God's just like, no. And there's this moment of reckoning within God's own life. He's like, what have I done? I mean, after all of this, all the grief and regret, all the destruction and corruption and violence, after God's memory has rescued them, after all of God's grace, Noah emerges. Nothing has changed. Chaos survived the flood. The Yetzer Hara survived the flood. And he immediately starts making a mess of things. God says every inclination, Yetzer, of the human heart is raw, is bad from childhood. And so we're left with the question again. What's God going to do? What kind of God is this? And this is what happens. God makes this promise. Never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is bad, raw from childhood. Never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. And then comes Genesis 8 and 9. This section where God sort of retraces the early Genesis 1 and 2 creation story. He gives them dominion over the animals of the earth. He tells them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. He tells them what to eat and not eat, just like with the trees. It's a new creation story. Only this time, God enters into this explicit covenant relationship with humanity. It's like God realized the only way they're going to figure this out is if we live in fidelity. God and these people, and then these people with each other. And what the Hebrew people do in preserving this story is they preserve the memory not of an angry, vengeful, violent God, but of this God of grace, of endless second chances. God gives him actually a symbol of God's grace, of the promise. The symbol is the rainbow. That's the major symbol of the Noah story, is not just the flood, it's the rainbow. And it's not like a bow or ribbon that ties up a little girl's pigtails. It's a bow, like a bow and arrow bow. It's a weapon of war, of hostility and violence and retribution and revenge. God takes the weapon and lays it on its side, and that's the bow. And just declares peace with all of creation and promises never to hand them over to the chaos again. Now God will be joined so completely to them. God will just walk through whatever comes. God will always remember them, will always have more grace just to keep going, endless second chances. And never again will I just give you over to your whatever you're going to work, your Yetzer Hara. And it's a turning point in the story of God. God's solution to the problem of humanity's brokenness will not be retribution. It'll be grace and this covenant. God, he's like, I will always walk with you. I don't care how bad it gets. I'll never leave you to your own devices again. This is the story they hand to us. And so every time I go through this or teach through it, I'm left always asking, like, what kind of story do we tell ourselves about God? Because this story is really complex. This God is not untainted by the human brokenness. God is bearing it with us all along. This sounds like cross, you know? But what kind of story we tell about this God, it's going to have a huge impact on our lives. We're going to pass it on to our kids, to our friends and neighbors and coworkers. Is it a story of grace and endless second chances? Or is it this God who hates who we hate and wants to destroy them? And it turns out that the way of judgment and exclusion and condemnation, it always leads to violence, and it always just floods the world and disorders it. And God, what God has promised is, I don't want to ever give you over to that chaos again. And then invites us to see, you know, violence always just produces more violence in this spiral of retribution and loss. And God is not looking for that. God is looking for order. And the kind of order God is looking for only will come through grace. It stems from grace. And that's the defining symbol of the story. It's not the flood, it's the ark. It's not the waters or the death and destruction. It's the bow, the rainbow, the sign of peace, of covenanting, of always coming back for more, endless chances, endless second chances. The story of Noah and the flood in the end is about a God of endless second chances. And it makes me wonder what could happen if we all begin to tell that story about God. If we imitate that story, embody it in the way we live our lives. Let's pray. Oh God, we do want to live a story of grace and endless second chances. We want to have a grown-up picture of you and your response to the mess we've made, one that doesn't overwhelm our freedom, but that doesn't leave us alone, you know? But we feel so alone, and we're still making messes. So our prayer is that we can hold you to this story, that you'll just keep coming back with endless second chances, with fidelity and covenant, and that you'll walk with us because we need you here. Amen.